Welcome to the Divided Kingdom, the evening news program that is Christian-based and has commentary and analysis. This is Elizabeth Cuppett Caverly.
And this is Lou Caverly.
In another time in America, the old beloved America that we all recall, there was something that happened 72 years ago, and in the Eastern Maryland Star Democrat, Henley Moore wrote about it. 72 years after an attack on the United States transport ship, the USAT Dorchester, killed 672 men, the American Legion Post 70 in Easton remembered four of the men in particular who were lost on Sunday, February 1st. Anglican priest, the Reverend Brad Anderson, told those in attendance at the ceremony at the Legion the story of how four lieutenants in the Army, Methodist minister George Fox, Rabbi Alexander Good, Reformed Church in America minister Clark Poling, and Roman Catholic priest John Washington, gave their lives so that others could live. Greater love hath no man than to give his life for his brother. Why would anyone do that? What compels anyone to give up their life? For what reason? Anderson asked. In the early morning hours of February 3, 1943, while on its way to the Army command base at Narsarsuaq, Greenland, from St. John's, Newfoundland, the Dorchester was torpedoed by a German U-boat. The damage was severe and power was lost, preventing the crew from sending radio signals for help. The Dorchester sank in about 20 minutes. Although some were able to seek refuge in the few lifeboats that survived the attack, most of the more than 900 aboard died in the water from hypothermia. The testimonies of the survivors tell us that the sole order in that ferment of struggling men, that the only fragment of hope came from the four chaplains who suddenly appeared on the sloping starboard side, Anderson said. After calmly passing out life jackets, Anderson spoke of further accounts of survivors seeing the four chaplains joined arm in arm, praying in the brief moments before the Dorchester sank. They represent not only the best of the clergy, but best of what the spirit of America can produce, said Rabbi Peter Hyman, who joined Anderson along with Post 70 chaplain Robert Schaefer and United Methodist Church retired minister Reverend Fred Baer, in telling about each man and lighting a candle in remembrance of each of the immortal chaplains as they have become to be referred to as. It's important when we have such a powerful example of what America at its best can represent that we rehearse the story, perpetuate the story, and teach the story. Through an act of Congress in 1988, February 3rd is recognized as Four Chaplains Day. Now, Herbert Shapiro, a member of the American Legion, Post 278 in Stevensville, and president of the 11th Airborne Division Association, came to the ceremony. He said because he thinks the Four Chaplains' actions deserve commemoration. It really shows what the United States stands for. It's the true reason of why this country was established. Anderson said he believed it was God's love that compelled these men to sacrifice their lives and help their fellow Americans in a time of despair. It seems so antiquated now, doesn't it, to hear an article like that and to hear about men who did what those four chaplains did, because we're in a completely different time and we are losing our faith. And we are getting away from God's laws and His doctrine. So, of course, we're going to be seeing a lot of sinister cover-ups and things going on. We had a little follow-up to the case that True News talked about, the big mansion fire in Maryland near Annapolis. And the grandfather in the case had very high connections to the NSA and other things. And the question was, what did he know? Did he know too much? So now they have come out with the AP saying that the Office of the Chief Medical Examiner released the findings confirming the deaths were accidental. Dawn and Sandra Pyle and their four grandchildren who were killed in the January 19th fire near Annapolis, they say that it was caused after an electric spark spread to a 15-foot Christmas tree. And this blaze reduced a 16,000-square-foot riverfront mansion to ashes. Well, perhaps we have the truth, perhaps we don't. Then we look at the case of the bombing suspect, the brother, Jokhar Tsarnaev, and of course Tamerlan is no longer with us. And they're going to try to make this case that this was the brother copying rather innocently the older brother, the role model of the older brother. And they do mention in this article one interesting thing that the AP said, and this was February 2nd. Prosecutors have said that a friend of Tamerlan, and of course that was the older brother, killed when they were getting him, Ibrahim Todashev, implicated him in the killings of three men in Waltham whose bodies were found sprinkled with marijuana, their throats cut. Todashev was shot to death by an FBI agent after authorities said he charged another investigator with a pole while being questioned about the Tsarnaevs. Of course, we heard on InfoWars that that was very questionable, too. We have to just take that without evidence that the prosecutors said this is what happened, that he charged them with a pole. But really, did he have some other information about the FBI connections, the roommate, and all of that? That were these men somewhat trained? How many of these rabid jihadists in ISIS were trained at Yemen? And what are the connections with the West in doing that training? Again, is it like Dr. Stanley Monteith said, we're training the best enemy that money can buy? It certainly looks questionable. So those are some of the sinister cover-ups. And there's a bigger one, isn't there, Lou? A pretty big one, I think, a little more extensive. We all recall about Private Jessica Lynch and that big fabricated story, her heroism in the Iraq War. And when she appeared on the Alex Jones show, he advised her, you'd better tell the truth quickly or they will kill you, because he knew about the D.C. madam, what happened. He urged her to reveal names and so forth and so on, and she didn't, and she was found strangely dead, supposedly a suicide. But Jessica Lynch did come out right away and admitted that it was a staged thing, and she's alive. Now, I wonder whether anything else has been staged lately.
Nobody died at Sandy Hook. Event was just a FEMA drill, Shanley's civil lawsuit says. The Fort Fairfield Journal, datelined January 7th, 2015, from Arista County, Maine. And this is by David Duchesne. Civil lawsuits totaling over $1 trillion have been filed in the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia, make that the District of Connecticut, against several mainstream news corporations regarding their alleged spreading of the hoax of mass shooting deaths at the Sandy Hook Elementary School in 2012. Author and documentary filmmaker William Brandon Shanley from New London, Connecticut, has filed the civil lawsuits after it was determined the alleged mass shooting was merely just a drill at an abandoned school. Nobody died at the school building on that day, and various news reporting companies were working in conjunction with the Federal Emergency Management Agency and others who were politically motivated in order to present a FEMA National Level Exercise, or NLE drill, as if it were a factual event. Annual crime statistics released by the FBI last fall indicate that nobody was murdered in Newtown, Connecticut in 2012, thus conflicting with the government's and mainstream media's account of the story where they claimed nearly 24 people died as a result of a mass shooting there. Quote, after exhaustive research, the good news is that overwhelming evidence reveals that no children or teachers died at Sandy Hook 2 years ago, Mr. Shanley said in a press release. For relief, I have filed lawsuits against the media in U.S. District Court in New Haven for fraud and terrorism. He also claims the famous photo of a female police officer leading children away from the school that appeared in several national publications was staged and did not even occur on the day of the alleged shooting. According to the press release, Shanley plans to call as witnesses investigative journalist for Veterans Today, Dr. James Fetzer, Ph.D., and former Florida State Trooper Wolfgang Halbig, who has also closely investigated the event and has information revealing that it was a false flag. In addition to being on the editorial board of Veterans Today, Dr. Fetzer, a former U.S. Marine Corps officer, is also distinguished McKnight University Professor Emeritus at the University of Minnesota, Duluth. He has published more than 100 articles and reviews and 20 books in the philosophy of science and on the theoretical foundations of computer science, artificial intelligence, and cognitive science. William Shanley has undertaken, and this is a quote, William Shanley has undertaken a most courageous step by bringing a series of lawsuits related to the fraud known as Sandy Hook. I have published dozens of articles about it, among the most recent being Rejoice for Christmas, No One Died at Sandy Hook, or at the Boston Bombing, and The Sandy Hook Hoax, How We Know It Didn't Happen. Another telling article is Sandy Hook Redux, Obama Officials Confirm That It Was a Drill and No Children Died. We are dealing with facts, not opinions, and not speculation, said Fetzer, who has published these articles in Veterans Today. Among, and this is continuing on, the, on with a quote, among our findings are, one, that Sandy Hook Elementary School was closed by 2008 and used as a prop in 2012. Two, that there should have been some 469 students to evacuate, but no evacuation was taking place because no students were there. Three, the quote-unquote iconic photograph, where the children were even rearranged to get the best shot, was staged. And four, the official report by Danbury State's attorney, Stephen Sandusky, does not establish a causal nexus that ties the alleged shooter to his victims or weapons he is alleged to have used, unquote, Fetzer told the Fort Fairfield Journal. He went on to say, we have even located the FEMA manual for a drill to be held on the 13th, an FBI confirmation that no one was murdered in Newtown in 2012. Anyone who thinks we are conspiracy nuts should look at the evidence. But I freely admit, we have to be just a bit crazy to be taking this on. As George Orwell observed, speaking the truth in times of universal deceit is a revolutionary act. This was fake terrorism, intended to instill fear into the American public to promote a political gun control agenda. It is fortunate that no one died. Unquote. Wolfgang Halbig, a former Florida state trooper and school administrator for 36 years, up to vice principal and principal, and a nationally recognized school safety expert, says it has taken him almost 2 years to put this school shooting conspiracy puzzle together. Quote, it probably would never have happened until two homicide investigators came to my home in Sorrento, Florida, from the Lake Country Sheriff's Office, with directors from the Connecticut State Police, that if I do not stop asking questions about Sandy Hook, then the Connecticut State Police will arrest me, Halbig told the Fort Fairfield Journal. Undaunted, Halbig points to crime scene photos taken from the Sandy Hook Elementary School showing it covered in water damage, mold, and in a general state of disrepair, looking like it had been abandoned for some time. And he says no school principal would have allowed their children to be taught in a place of such disrepair. Quote, no school principal would have ever allowed her school to be so filthy and deplorable looking, which so many people just do not understand, Halbig told the Fort Fairfield Journal. And he went on to say, go to an elementary school and look at how he or she maintains that school from the outside in. The inside must smell clean, look clean, and show that they have a school environment and school climate in which children can learn and teachers can teach. I investigated the Sandy Hook school shooting as a former school administrator, an angle which Homeland Security and FEMA failed to understand when writing the scripts for that event, unquote. The dilapidated state of the building indicates it had been abandoned for some time and was not occupied by staff or students on the day of the alleged shooting. Halbig also told the Fort Fairfield Journal that he believes the Sandy Hook stage shooting was part of a larger psyop designed to cause mass mental health issues in the society, thereby disarming a large portion of the populace. Quote, "It is not all about guns. It is all about mental health. If you have a mental health issue at an early age and it is documented, a decade later you will never be able to buy a gun. They are coming in the back door since our Constitution allows us to own guns, but not if you have a mental health issue," unquote. Shanley outlines how the defendants allegedly entered in a multi-year conspiracy, meeting in groups separately and together to commit fraud and terrorism. That is, to brainwash the public into thinking a lone gunman drill known as the Sandy Hook Massacre was real, when in fact it was a staged FEMA national-level exercise event that redirected government resources to terrorize the public. These crimes were undertaken with the intent of subverting the U.S. Constitution and to affect national, state, and local laws. This fraud involved lying to the public, faking news, publishing one-sided news reports, censoring reality, suppressing facts, and deliberately skewing the news to shift public perceptions. In a letter to the Sandy Hook Advisory Commission, Shanley says Sandy Hook justice alleges and would be willing to present evidence that, quote, "Sandy Hook Elementary School was abandoned by 2008 and used as a prop in 2012, that the iconic photograph taken by Shannon Hicks of the Newtown Bee was staged, that State's Attorney Stephen Sedensky did not show Adam Lanza committed a crime, that the death certificate for Noah Posner, provided by Lenny Posner, is not authentic," unquote. Hicks has denied staging the photograph. The legal principle, fraud vitiates everything, supports the conclusion that no one died at Sandy Hook. Extraordinary steps have been taken at the local and state level to deny access to relevant proof of death, apart from this fabricated death certificate for Noah Posner. Evidence that could confirm a crime took place is completely missing. This reveals human intent and manipulation of what has been presented as being real, writes Shanley. And the quotation goes on, "This appears to have been a made-for-media event, contemporaneous with a federal interagency and Connecticut Department of Public Protection and Safety drill and television production rolled out to create an entirely false community over a period of years projected into the real world using crisis actors, climaxing on the stage of a school that seems to have been closed for asbestos and biohazards and to avoid the expense of meeting ADA requirements. Two Connecticut state police officers have confided to Mr. Halbig that the 7,000-page document dump is the script for the drill. Internet records show that fundraising sites and photographs for the purported victims were operational 3 days before the event, and in some cases for even longer. Quote, "We are troubled that key officials and witnesses have fled or disappeared from the scene through retirement or death. The deaths of former New Haven Register reporter Michael Belmore, 27, and Major William Podgorski, 49, Western District Commander of the CTSP, one of the lead Sandy Hook investigators, are only two of a dozen illustrations." Shanley also says, according to Connecticut State's Attorney Stephen Sedensky's own report, there were no fingerprints on the .22 rifle that Adam allegedly used to shoot his mother. and even more surprisingly, that of the larger number of shots that were fired from the 5.56 caliber Bushmaster, close to 150 rounds. None of the bullet fragments could be matched to the weapon. The lawsuits name as defendants a multitude of national, regional, and local news, print, and television news reporting companies as allegedly being complicit in perpetuating the government's Sandy Hook shooting hoax. Shanley says punitive damages of 1 year's annual revenue from each defendant are being sought to establish a news trust that will free journalism and restore trust and integrity to our communication sources. He said, quote, "A democracy cannot survive this tyranny over human consciousness."
This article concerns all of us. And Jim Fetzer is a respected author. I know Lou has read his work on the JFK assassination. And it's so important that while we can, we shine the light of God's truth on the events that are around us. And as the article said, it said they're coming for us through the back door, and they are going to be looking at school children, and they're going to be fabricating their mental health, and they're going to then have the excuse to take away the gun. So much is involved here. But not only are they coming through the back door, they're coming for us overhead. In a local newspaper, again, the Eastern Star Democrat, we had a headline, "Army Blimp Project Takes Flight." And this is by Jacob Owens, Edgewood. Residents of Cecil County and beyond may have noticed a stray white blimp hovering on the horizon in recent weeks. It isn't a wayward Goodyear blimp, but rather a U.S. Army exercise that may one day help protect the homeland from airborne threats. Announced in June, the North American Aerospace Defense Command, NORAD, is leading the three-year exercise with the Army's Joint Land Attack Cruise Missile Defense Elevated Netted Sensor System, JLENS, at Aberdeen Proving Ground. In the waning days of December, military operators launched the first of two, quote, aerostats, or tethered lighter-than-aircraft, or blimps, in the project. Officials said the aerostats can stay in the air for a maximum of 30 days before they will need to be brought back to the mooring station for maintenance. The 243-foot-long blimps are tethered to the ground at altitudes up to 10,000 feet above sea level, meaning that they can be seen for miles in all directions. While a farmer in Kent County, Maryland, may be able to see the aerostat in the sky, the JLENS radar system will stretch much farther, up to 340 miles, putting areas in Ohio, Virginia, New York, and beyond into its range. The system works in combination with NORAD's land-based radar systems in order to expand the defense network, said Army Major Elizabeth Kreft, NORAD/NORTHCOM spokeswoman. The JLENS system provides persistent over-the-horizon radar surveillance and fire control quality data that enables protection from a wide variety of threats, including manned and unmanned aircraft, she said. The primary purpose for the JLENS system is to enable effective long-range battle space defense against threats such as fixed and rotary wing airplanes and land attack and anti-ship cruise missiles. The system itself works with a pair of aerostats, each serving a specific purpose. JLENS houses wide-area surveillance radar on one aerostat and a precision track radar on the other, she explained. These radars are much like FAA commercial aviation radars that track and identify aircraft and direct commercial aviation to airports. The three-year-old project has been tested by the Army on land, at sea, and in the air in a variety of tests, Kreft said. The project has cost roughly $2.7 billion to develop by Raytheon Company, according to a March 2013 Government Accountability Office report. Originally expected to produce 16 pairs, the project has since scaled back to two due to increased software costs and development delays, the report said. The second unit is being kept in storage at a Utah facility. While visible by the naked eye in the sky, Kreft said the public won't notice when the J-Lens is running exercises. Quote, the system only broadcasts a radar signal when aloft, and it poses no radiation or other dangers to the public or the environment, she said. Of note, inclusive in the site survey is an environmental impact study, and there are no expected environmental impacts, and there is no radiation hazard to the local population when J-Lens is flying. Upon conclusion of the three-year exercise in September 2017, the status of the aerostats will be determined, Kreft said. J-Lens is a key contributor to joint air and cruise missile defense capability objectives, so the exercise will assist in finding ways to improve the ability to detect and defend against airborne threats, she said. The overall goal is to increase decision time available to respond efficiently and accurately for the defense of the national capital region. As threats become more sophisticated, so must our capabilities to defend critical assets and infrastructure, and the J-Lens exercise will enable that improvement process. Army officials have repeatedly said that the aerostats will not carry weapons, cameras, or surveillance equipment during the three-year exercise, despite concerns voiced by privacy advocates. David Rocha, senior staff attorney for the American Civil Liberties Union of Maryland, said the aerostats present another platform for potential persistent surveillance, like unmanned aerial drones. Quote, unfortunately, this is another example of movement of battlefield technology to the domestic front, and we aren't the enemy, he said. There is a potential of privacy invasion on a massive scale. And I would just interject here that along with that 1.6 billion rounds of hollow point ammunition, and now it's more over 2 billion, I'm sure, we now are gathering everything in readiness if there's some kind of big civil unrest. When you think about this system, listeners, that it will stretch 340 miles, putting areas in Ohio, Virginia, New York, and beyond in its range. There won't be too many patriots able to be doing too much defense of the Constitution at a time like this blimp surveillance is in action, I think. It's just very interesting. Are these really to suppress us eventually in our domestic lives? Is this really an honest thing? That's what we're really wondering. Or is this one more rehearsal of something sinister being disguised as your everyday Army blimp project? Well, in January 2013, the article says Raytheon had touted the aerostat's ability to carry targeting software that could identify a single enemy combatant on the ground. That camera, however, is not a part of the current exercise over Maryland, according to both the Army and Raytheon. And again, if you believe that, maybe someone will sell you the Brooklyn Bridge. Rocha said mixed messages from the arming of its camera systems bring some credence to worries about surveillance. Quote, the technology exists to put powerful cameras capable of spotting a bird on the ground from 10,000 feet on the aerostats. No one would ever be able to walk out of their house without being tracked by the government, he said. We would all viscerally understand the impact if a police officer followed us every time we left the house. But when it is done from 10,000 feet, we tend not to notice. Rocha said that the ACLU has no evidence of surveillance equipment attached to the aerostats, but noted that federal decisions have exempted J-Lens from privacy regulations. Now, that doesn't give me comfort, does it? You, Lou?
No, the first thing I would ask is, why did they exempt them? I mean, when you have something like this, you're left scratching your head saying, why? Why are they exempt?
And back to what Rocha said, we don't have any concerns of the Army tracking missiles over the ocean, but this isn't all the platform is capable of doing or touted as being able to do, he said. Rocha also said that the J-Lens project may breathe new life into previous efforts to expand privacy protections. Legislation supported by former Republican State Senator Chris Schenck and Democratic State Senator Jamie Raskin to require a warrant for surveillance of a person in Maryland by drone died due to a lack of concern about such a scenario, Rokaw said. This technology exists, and it is coming, he added. We need to act now before it takes place. While the JLens project continues to raise eyebrows for some, U.S. Army Major General Bruce Crawford, a senior APG commander, told the Cecil Whig, that's a newspaper, this summer that attracting programs like JLens will help bolster employment numbers for the base, which is currently being examined for thousands of potential job cuts. He noted that the national security impact, an addition of more than 100 soldiers on base connected to the project, were benefits in the local community. I think there's a little bit of dis-ease, shall we say, and disease, too, in all of this. And the local paper then began to talk in an editorial, and this is what they added to it. Lou, tell us what they said.
David Roker, senior staff attorney, and this, by the way, is called High in the Sky. David Roker, senior staff attorney for the American Civil Liberties Union of Maryland, is concerned about the Army's surveillance technology, this battlefield blimp being deployed on the domestic front. We have some concerns, too, though we aren't grabbing our protective tinfoil hats just yet. Roker said, quote, the technology exists to put powerful cameras capable of spotting a bird on the ground from 10,000 feet on the aerostats. No one would ever be able to walk out of their house without being tracked by the government, unquote. While the Army is conducting its tests, our elected leaders need to reopen the books on our public surveillance laws. We have a whole lot of new technology out there for tracking people, their phones, their cars, and every keystroke of their computers. Kent County, and that's Kent County, Maryland, their Director of Emergency Services, Wayne Darrell, realized the potential safety threat should one of these 243-foot blimps get loose and fall from the sky. That's a whole lot of blimp coming down. There are plenty of farm fields on the shore for an aerostat to crash into, but what if it hits in the middle of Chestertown or Centerville or Easton? Darrell went before the Kent County Commissioners last month speaking about standard precautions first responders would take if a JLens blimp crashed. He also said a tether made from fibers stronger than Kevlar has not broken in 35 years, and that the Army gives only a 10% probability of a blimp crashing in Kent County. Good to know. As surveillance techniques continue to evolve, so too must our regulations and how the government is allowed to track its citizens. We're glad the Army hasn't totally wasted a couple billion dollars on a pair of blimps. We just hope they end being put to better use than watching Canada geese migrate down the shore.
And again, as we opened this program, we talked about the old America, the one in which those four chaplains gave up their lives for their men, and how different things are now in America. And some of that difference is shown by this article right here. February 2nd, 2015, AP, bill would allow terminally ill people to end their lives. Annapolis, AP, two Maryland lawmakers are planning to introduce a measure that would allow terminally ill people in Maryland to end their lives. Delegate Shane Pendergrass, Democrat of Howard County, and Senator Ronald Young, Democrat of Frederick, said they plan to introduce similar bills this week that would allow adults given only 6 months to live the ability to get a prescription for drugs to hasten their death. It's become something that people are starting to think about, Pendergrass said. It seems from what I've read that a majority of people are in favor of having control over the ends of their lives. To qualify for the prescription, an adult patient must be given a terminal diagnosis from their physician with no more than 6 months to live. The person must also be of sound mind and obtain oral and written consent from two doctors. Once the patient is given the prescription, it is his or her decision to fill it and use it. Senate President Thomas V. Mike Miller, Democrat of Calvert County, told reporters last week he would watch the progress of the bill in the House of Delegates. The Senate voted in the late 1990s to block doctors from assisting patients in suicide. Quote, "It's an issue that people have profound feelings on," Miller, who is Catholic, said. "My religion says I should be opposed to it, but personally, I don't look with disfavor upon the idea." Maryland Governor Larry Hogan's office declined to say whether the governor would sign such a bill because it is so early in the session and it remains to be seen what a final bill might look like. Quote, "We are in the very beginning of a long legislative session, and as we all know, most bills have the tendency to look much different by the time April comes around," said Erin Montgomery, Hogan's spokeswoman. Oregon, Washington, Montana, New Mexico, and Vermont are the only states that have made it legal for terminally ill people to hasten their deaths. Let's hear that again. Oregon, Washington, Montana, New Mexico, and Vermont. Other states, including California, Colorado, Iowa, Kansas, and the District of Columbia, recently have introduced legislation. The issue was thrust into national headlines last autumn when Brittany Maynard, an Oregon woman diagnosed with terminal brain cancer, decided to take her own life with prescription drugs and used her scheduled death to advocate for more acceptance of death with dignity. Young said Maynard's story was one of the factors in his sponsorship of the bill. "I just thought it's time to allow that in Maryland," he said. "I frankly would like that choice when the time comes." George Imay, vice president of the Death with Dignity National Center in Portland, Oregon, also credited Maynard with bringing the issue to light, but said the aging baby boomer generation is also the reason the idea of hastening death is getting attention. They're recognizing they want to have control of those decisions they will be facing at end of life, Imay said, not only the medical treatment they receive, but those final days. Among groups watching the momentum is Not Dead Yet, a Rochester, New York-based national advocacy group opposed to such legislation. Quote, "We've seen bills introduced already in more states than previous years," said Diane Coleman, president of Not Dead Yet. "If someone says they want to die, the response from others should always be, no, no, you're valuable. What can we do to help?" We've seen the statistics about the Netherlands since this was initiated, and we've read articles about the disappearance of the seniors. There are many, many fewer senior people there. And this is opening the door to absolute murder of many, many, many people. This is the beginning of the Hitler-type program. It will turn into that, in which the mentally ill and the defective children were rounded up, taken, and then their parents received notices that they died of pneumonia later. And that was the program that really began the later unfolding of the concentration camp death sites. It began in a littler way, you see, getting these children and who were supposedly deformed and these adults who were mentally defective, et cetera, by their standards. All of this was opening the door because, again, we're not valuing what God says in the Bible, that we are valued because we are created in His image. No, so we have Senate President Thomas Mike Miller saying that even though his religion as a Catholic tells him he should be honoring a life, personally, he's going to rebel. He's going to look with disfavor upon God's rules. He is going to look upon what man would like to do. We're never too far from Aleister Crowley, "Do what thou wilt," are we, Lou, when we decide to live according to our human dictates?
Well, that's exactly right. If you have no higher rules to live by, no morality, no ethics, then it is just whatever you feel like doing, because there's no higher power. If you reject the idea of a God and what He has revealed to man, then it has to be whatever I feel like doing, I'll do, and whatever the next person feels like doing, they'll do. And ultimately, it's might makes right.
And ultimately, just like that eye in the sky, it may come to your doorstep. If we have time, we'll read the very sad story of a mother who found her son dead of a heroin overdose. And this isn't just yesterday. This happened some time back. But, see, we think these things are not going to affect us directly, but because we have lost all of our moral standards at the highest levels of government and we've allowed the satanic Marxism to come in, then we see in the AP February 3rd this headline, Mexican opium farmers expand plots to supply U.S. heroin boom. Sierra Madre del Sur, Mexico. Red and purple blossoms with fat, opium-filled bulbs blanket the remote creek sides and gorges of the Philo Mayor Mountains in the southern state of Guerrero. The multi-billion dollar Mexican opium trade starts here, with poppy farmers so poor they live in wood plank, tin-roofed shacks with no indoor plumbing. Mexican farmers from three villages interviewed by the AP are feeding a growing addiction in the U.S., where heroin use has spread from back alleys to the cul-de-sacs of suburbia. The heroin trade is a losing prospect for everyone except the Mexican cartels, who have found a new way to make money in the face of falling cocaine consumption and marijuana legalization in the United States. Once smaller-scale producers of low-grade black tar, Mexican drug traffickers are now refining opium paste into high-grade white heroin and flooding the world's largest market for illegal drugs using the distribution routes they built for marijuana and cocaine. It is a business that even the farmers don't like. In a rare interview with reporters, the villagers told the AP that it's too difficult to ship farm products on roads so rough and close to the sky that cars are in constant danger of tumbling off the single-lane dirt roads that zigzag up to the fields. They say the small plastic-wrapped bricks of gummy opium paste are the only thing that will guarantee them a cash income. Almost everyone thinks the people in these mountains are bad people, and that's not true, said Humberto Nava Reina, the head of the Supreme Council of the Towns of the Philo Mayor, a group that promotes development projects in the mountains. They can't stop planting poppies as long as there is demand, and the government doesn't provide any help.
Villagers granted the AP access to their farms and agreed to interviews only if they were not identified, fearing it could draw attention from government drug eradicators or vengeful traffickers. Residents say there are no local users. They hate the taste of the bitter paste, which they sometimes rub into their gums to soothe an aching tooth. It all goes for export, a lucrative business mostly run by the Sinaloa cartel. According to the DEA's 2014 National Drug Threat Assessment, Mexico produces nearly half of the heroin found in the United States, up from 39% in 2008. While Afghanistan is by far the world's largest producer, it largely sends to markets in Europe and Asia. Mexican government seizures of opium and eradication of poppy plantations have skyrocketed in recent years. The trends are consistent. Opium paste seizures in Mexico were up 500% between 2013 and 2014. Poppy field eradications were up 47%. And seizures of the processed drug increased 42%. Along the U.S. border, they are three times what they were in 2009. Mexican heroin has become cheaper and more powerful at a time when Americans hooked on pharmaceutical opiates are looking for an affordable alternative. Combined with dangerous additives like fentanyl, a synthetic opiate also produced in Mexico, it is blamed for a wave of new addictions and overdoses in the U.S. Heroin deaths doubled from 2011 to 2013, while deaths from cocaine and prescription opiates remain steady, according to the Centers for Disease Control. It used to be that Mexican cartels shipped brown heroin from Colombia, along with their homegrown black tar. But all producers are making the high-grade white now, and Mexican criminal gangs have learned that they can increase their profits exponentially if they manage the whole production chain, as with methamphetamines, which they also control from precursor to user. When the poppy plants finish flowering about 3 months into the winter growing season, a farmer armed with a razor-sharp thumb scorer and a metal scraping pan can collect 300 grams of opium paste worth 4,000 pesos, more than $275 in a single day. The price for the relatively low-quality marijuana the farmers used to grow at lower elevations has fallen, possibly because of the legalization and medical use of higher-quality U.S. marijuana. Most law enforcement officials still say it's still too early to document an impact. But the farmers see a change. They only get about 250 pesos, about $17 per dried pressed kilogram, that is 2.2 pounds of marijuana, compared to 13,000 pesos, nearly $900 per kilo of opium paste. One wiry farmer with a joking manner and a baseball cap noted that's more than he could make in a month at any legitimate job, if there were any legitimate jobs around. But they can lose a season's work in a few minutes to the government's helicopters that spray powerful herbicides on any fields they find. Many farmers say they would like to give up poppy cultivation and plant legitimate crops, in part because of the bloodshed the trade has brought. Some growers are trying. In two of the three self-admitted opium-growing villages the AP visited, residents have tried planting avocados, a crop that can bring cash income at similar altitudes in the neighboring state of Michoacán. They have also built trout ponds. But the trout are small because of a lack of food, and avocados take at least 7 years before they yield a viable amount of green, shiny fruit. One farmer proudly showed off the 2- and 3-year-old avocado trees he had planted on a steep hillside plot of about 20 acres. Because the trees can produce for 4 or 5 decades, he may someday have a plot his children and grandchildren can make a living from. But cultivation is expensive. So meanwhile, the farmer walked further down his plot into a narrow creek valley where his, quote, flower garden, unquote, grows. He waited to score his bulbs into noon, quote, because the sun draws the gum out, unquote. This, he said, pointing to the poppy bulb he has just scribed with a cutting tool to let the sap leak out, is what finances that, he said, pointing uphill to the avocado trees.
And we say that these terrible problems that are going to come home to visit us here have grown into such a gargantuan evil because America's faith has faltered. It still isn't at such a point as is in Europe when we brought to you recently the news that many of the churches are closing in places like even Denmark. All of these countries are losing their Christianity very, very much. And here, there's always been a sort of a poison in America from the time of the earliest days of the Republic. And yes, we know that many of our ancestors came over on the Mayflower and they came for religious freedom, but we also had the Illuminati faction. And, you know, as time goes on, Lou and I decided we really are getting farther and farther away from being patriot radio hosts. Because there are certain things that we just can't go with. Too much of it. The libertarianism is just do what thou wilt. And, you know, we watch these figures now, this controversy of the vaccines. We had people taking a moral stand. Rand Paul took a moral stand. Then he backed back and he showed himself getting a booster shot. You see, when we compromise, if we know the truth that there are real dangers in many of the vaccines and there is a definite link to autism, there has to be something there. Lou, as a math teacher, sees it's just unreal that a few decades ago we had 1 in 10,000 children as being autistic, and now it's something like 1 in 50. Something is radically wrong in a mathematical sense, and there are things being covered up. And yes, we know that if vaccines are good, they could be very helpful. If they're not filled with things that are sinister and bad for us, they could be very helpful. I myself had the measles, and I was delirious. And that means that I was having a raging problem in my brain. I could have died with the measles, but I didn't, and I'm here. And, you know, God has watched over all of us. I got the polio vaccine. So did Lou. And in my diary, my teenage diary, I noted 3 days later I was never so sick in my life with a very high fever. I've wondered whether I had polio. I really have wondered. And, of course, right after that, I broke out with a strange rash that many years later a doctor, an expert, said you had lupus, you didn't have psoriasis, which is what the local family doctor thought I had, gave me a cortisone shot or two. And then he said, thank God that worked. I think he realized there was something ominous hanging over me, and he wasn't quite sure it was the psoriasis that he had diagnosed. Now, I've actually said to Lou, I would far rather have had the lupus than have had the polio like a girl in my hometown had, and had a great paralysis, and it changed her whole lifestyle much more dramatically than mine has been changed. So you see, first of all, I am trusting in God that he's watching over my life plan. And that's so important that we have this faith and that we do try to bring out the evils. And it's encouraging now that there's a debate that's actually out in the public with these presidential figures, these hopefuls, about the vaccines. This cannot be anything but good, because sooner or later, more truth is going to have to come out. We had an article some time back that we never got on the air, but it was hushing up one of the last vaccine whistleblowers. But you see, God won't allow everything to be hushed up, because the light of his truth will shine. But when I said this poison has been in the Republic for a long time, this is something that was part of an article, really, I guess, a letter to the editor in a local paper, and it was very, very anti-Christian. It was condemning the fundamentalists, that all of the fundamentalist Christians in the past, quote, chopped off heads, cut out tongues, stoned people to their skulls caved in, hacked off their breasts, so forth and so on, as if this was just a matter of fact being, the ordinary activities of most Christians, and it certainly isn't. There were periods in history when bad, terrible things happened, like the Inquisition. But this isn't the standard modus operandi of Christianity, not like the dictates of the Quran that we're seeing. We're seeing these people killed, the Japanese guy and now the other guy. It's just not very good. But anyway, in this letter, he mentioned Thomas Jefferson to back up his point that faith should be mocked. The title of his letter to the editor was When Faith Needs Mocking. He says this, Thomas Jefferson mocked faith and justified it when he wrote, quote, ridicule is the only weapon which can be used against unintelligible propositions. Ideas must be distinct before reason can act upon them, and no man ever had a distinct idea of the Trinity. It is the mere abracadabra of the mountebanks calling themselves the priests of Jesus. And that was a letter to Francis Adrian Vanderkemp, July 30th, 1816, from the Buffalo Historical Society. And this writer said, faith needs mocking when taken too seriously by fundamentalists. Some of these pronouncements by some of these people, including Thomas Jefferson, when he decided that he would remake the Bible and only take out the words of Jesus and he'd get rid of what he thought was superfluous or not according to his plan. This kind of pomposity, I would hate to think of God's reaction. And so if this is someone were to emulate, Thomas Jefferson, yes, I'm thankful for many of his ideas of freedom, but I certainly wouldn't emulate his feelings about religion. I wouldn't want to emulate being him. I would rather be just little Elizabeth Cubitt Caverly here in the 21st century, raising my voice, pleading for repentance in this beloved country that my late father loved so much, as he served the ordinary people as a mail carrier up in those Allegheny Mountains, and as a wonderful statesman-like person there who fought for good roads and did so many things for the people he came in contact with. No, the only hope for us is for our country to repent, don't you think, Lou?
Yes, I think that's exactly the case. I don't think this country can stand to have its morality ripped to shreds. If it doesn't repent, I think it's going to go the way of ancient Rome. Bread and circuses, and what else? What else will it have?
And according to Jeremiah, invasion. So now if we move to the international scene, first of all, we have to realize that we have to be very worried about the plans of the West putting the pressure on Ukraine. Obama waves sending lethal assistance to Ukraine, AP, February 3rd. Obama has waived sending lethal aid to Ukraine before, but has always decided against taking that step. But holding fast to that position has left him isolated within his administration. Given the support for sending the Ukrainians defensive assistance from high-ranking officials, including Secretary of State John Kerry and NATO Commander General Philip Breedlove. And this same article says that Angela Merkel is refusing to do such a thing. Merkel said Monday that Germany will not provide weapons to Ukraine and prefers economic sanctions and negotiations to, quote, solve or at least mitigate the conflict. Quote, it is my firm belief that this conflict cannot be solved militarily, Merkel said. There's some voice of sanity, and we need to have sanity. According to analyst Rick Wiles on True News, he believes that this is really connected to the alternative money system, the global money system that the BRICS nations are trying to develop, because it's threatening the West and the New World Order folks who have their own way of doing things, like QE3, et cetera, et cetera. So these BRICS nations, and I believe that's Brazil, India, China, South Africa, you know, so that we just have to be watching this, because it's going to get very serious. If they keep pushing and pushing for war, what will be the repercussions of that here? Gary Call has an article, Arousing the Russian Bear. We'll probably bring that to you next time in more depth. But he says in his closing paragraph, will the U.S. or Russia back down, or will tensions continue to escalate? We'll have to wait and see. Meanwhile, follow God's leading in making preparations for you and your family, both physical and spiritual. Stay alert and vigilant as Jesus urges us repeatedly in his word. Make him the cornerstone of your life. And we've heard from a pastor in Nigeria. God bless him. We've helped him. We hope we have. When we know that thousands of Christians are being harmed there and 1,000 churches were burned, according to Dr. Peter Hammond on True News. Please pray for those Christians. Good night.